Hi, Sue Hall here. Welcome to the third podcast in our fourth series of Talking the Dis Out of Dyslexia, hosted by the whole Dyslexic Society. On March 27th, 2021, TEDx Bear Creek Park live streamed 12 talks, and I was privileged to be one of the speakers. We've already heard from our MC, Noel Bendley, and now I'm delighted to introduce Olav Krikkelsen. He's joining us from the University of Victoria, and funny enough, his one-on-one coach for the TED Talk was Noel Bendley. Brilliant. So welcome, Olav. And Olav is a man of many hats, a professional basketball player in England and New Zealand, a mountaineer. He was awarded a fellowship to Bristol University as a visiting professor. He's been on Discovery Channel, Rick Mercer, CBC's Quirks and Quarks, and featured in Maclean's magazine. So he is a real high flyer who actually really does want to go to Mars.
Thanks for having me, Sue.
You're very, very welcome. So for those of you who haven't been able to listen to your talk just yet, I think, if I'm correct, it was about a device that has enabled you to track brainwave activity, specifically to establish without a doubt whether someone is tired or not. Was I listening?
You were listening, yeah.
So can you elaborate on that a little?
Yeah, of course. When I was doing my PhD, I finished that in 2008. EEG was kind of what people see on the hospital show, right? There was like a 32 or 64 electrodes on your head. It took you like an hour to put on, and you would measure someone's brainwaves. And what's happened since then, the revolution started about 2014, I guess, 2013, is like everything else, EEG has got smaller and not more powerful like cell phones, but definitely smaller. So the example I use is that when cell phones first came out, everyone remembers the big foot-long brick with an antenna. And now we have these tiny little things that they're basically supercomputers that you carry around. Well, EEG is the same way. So in my lab, we work with a bunch of what I call mobile EEG technologies. The one I use in my TED Talk was built into a pair of sunglasses, but the most common one we use is just a headband. So it looks like a headband that you'd wear, and it's got a bunch of sensors around it that measure your brainwaves.
Brilliant, brilliant. So the point of measuring the brainwaves, the point that I gathered from your talk, was basically you're totally capable of really defining whether somebody is too tired to work or not. Say you have a bus driver and he wears the EEG and the brainwaves say, no, you're really not fit for work, or a pilot. To me, that seems incredibly useful.
That's exactly what we're trying to do. So we do a whole range of projects in different areas, but the one I focused on my talk was the fatigue work we've done. And you've described it perfectly, Sue. Like some of the environments we've done research with, like when we work with NASA and the astronauts, these are people that will never tell you they're tired. Like they could literally be falling asleep in front of you and they'll say, no, I can still do this. And medical doctors in some situations act the same way.
Yeah.
So the idea is you can put the headband on, and using like an app that we built and an iPhone, you can tell if someone's tired or not in a couple of minutes.
Right.
And you don't need to worry about their opinion. And the best part is they can't fake it because we're reading their brain.
That's so interesting. So this is a very non-scientific question. How can you tell, like one person's tiredness might be different to another person's tiredness or not?
In terms of cognitive fatigue, so we don't look at physical fatigue, okay, like when your muscles are sore, we look at cognitive fatigue, so when the brain is tired. The amplitude, so the size of the signals, different between people, but the pattern is the same.
Okay.
So the overall pattern is the same. Just like us speaking, we say the same words and they sound differently because of our muscles that generate speech and the rest of it.
Right.
But the pattern of speech is the same. So if we looked at a recording of the speech,
yeah,
it would generally look the same for the same word.
Got it. Oh, that's interesting. That's very cool. So where do you get your ideas from? And I'm asking this because from my talk, you've probably understood that I feel there are these two ways of thinking. There are the picture thinkers who are pretty random in their thoughts, and then there are the sound-based thinkers who are pretty much linear and sequential. And if you're a mathematician, I would probably put you in the linear sequential bracket, but you generate so many ideas that that would sort of put you in the other end of the continuum.
Yeah, I would say I'm a mix of both. I guess the way I describe it is I get my ideas from all around me. You know, when I teach sometimes at the university, as I have a dialogue with my student, it, an idea might result in a question. You know, sometimes reading something triggers something, or seeing something triggers something. Yeah. So I guess the way my brain works is a little bit of both. And and it depends on the mode I'm in. So when I'm in an idea generation mode, it's a bit more of this sort of, you know, what's around me. And it's not as linear. And to be fair, you know, sometimes the work you do generates more ideas. So when we started playing around with the mobile EEG systems, you know, we tackled cognitive fatigue, but then we sat around at a lab meeting and said, well, what else can we do? Mm-hmm. And people were just throwing out ideas, and we sort of went, well, that sounds good. Now, what about this? And
so sometimes you get too many ideas. You don't know where to start.
I wish I had 72 hours in a day. We have so many projects we could be chasing. And like everything in this world, we're limited by money and time.
Yeah, it's true. So having done one TEDx, how do you feel about that experience? And would you be up for doing another one?
Yeah. How do I feel? Well, it was an amazing experience. I'm sure you felt the same way. Watching myself on the red dot, you know, the TED sign in the background, it was good.
Yeah.
It was a very trying experience. When I said I'd do it, I didn't realize how much practice and rehearsal there'd be. Most of the talks I give are kind of off the cuff because I'm talking about my area of expertise.
Yeah.
And I usually have a couple slides to rely on to cue me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was an amazing experience, but it was a lot of work. And I would probably do it again.
When you were memorizing your talk, do you know how that worked for you? Did you see the pages? Did you print the talk out? Did you see the pages in your mind as you went along? Or?
Yeah, I'm an older generation like yourself. So I physically printed a copy and I would go for my walk in the morning and I would just try to say it. And then when I got stuck, I'd break out my words and go. And my son helped me a lot. My son does theater and he's done some public speaking. Yeah, so he would listen to me and correct me when I said it wrong. And yeah, but it was basically just pure brute force. The only thing I did was because I study learning for a living is one of the core research areas we do, is I broke it into small chunks. Like I would only do 10 or 15 minutes at a time. And then I would walk away from it and come back. So as opposed to doing an hour straight, I broke it up. And that's called distribution of practice. It's one of the most studied learning phenomena in the world. And it works really well. It's this idea that you take large amounts of time and break them into smaller. So it's something I teach in my classes. So I figured if I'm going to teach it to students, I should probably, you know, practice what you preach is what they say, right?
Exactly. That's how I do my taxes. Oh, dear. Yeah, I can't do it all in one go. It's too hard. I printed mine off too. Obviously, I'm in the paper world and I could see the paragraphs and I could see the bullet points. But because of my picture thinking, I then drew little like, sort of shapes around the paragraphs sometimes. And then, of course, we had to add the movements, the hand movements, right? Which is not difficult for me because I do talk with my hands, right? But it's not easy for everyone, right?
Well, the hard part I found is when I teach at the university, I never stand in one spot. Like I want to walk back and forth. Like frequently, I'll teach from the back of the classroom, just throw them for a loop. So just being planted really impaired my body movement. Like I really struggled with it because my body movements are usually really natural when I'm just flowing.
Yeah.
But what I found when they nailed my feet to the spot, I struggled with that.
Yeah. No, that was interesting. Again, when you've got real people in front of you, you feed off their reactions and there weren't any real people.
That was the hardest part for me was not having an audience. I spoke at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas a couple of years ago at something called the Digital Health Summit. And a crowd of 5,000, you know, my typical class is 100 students. So to have, you know, four people in the audience, I didn't know where to look. I didn't know who to engage. And because they've heard your talk so many times, they respond to it differently as well, right?
Yes, exactly. And they had masks, so you couldn't even see if they were smiling, could you?
The first time. Exactly.
Oh, dear. No, that was difficult. But you'd do it all again, I'm sure.
I would. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you have your students in your lecture theater, do you see how you have different learners in your lectures? Do you see people very sound-based and people who are very image-based?
Definitely. I try to teach as much as I can between the two.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't lecture, so I teach a bit differently. So one of the things that I do is what's called a flipped classroom. this is a new sort of idea in teaching. What I tell my students is the traditional university lecture is the professor walks in, they put up some PowerPoint slides, and then they read their slides to their students for the next hour. And I say to my students on the first day when I explain how I actually teach, I say, look, my son's 13 and doesn't need me to read to him. So I don't see how you kids in university need me to read PowerPoint slides to you. So in a flipped classroom, what you do is I have a website for my class and I post three questions or four questions that they have to have the answer to before they come to class. And I put up YouTube content to support it and readings. So I give them a bunch of mediums there. And then when they come to class every day, there's a quiz on those questions. And they answer the quiz. And then I do a bunch of post-quiz activities. Sometimes they grade each other. Sometimes I grade them. Sometimes they grade themselves. And then what I do is I post the exam question for the day. So there's an exam question associated with every class. There's about 22 classes in a semester. And I don't give them 22 exam questions. I pick a subset randomly. But what they do is that the background questions and readings, the whole purpose is that's the material they need to answer the exam question. So then what I do from there is provide some activities that might help guide them. And then usually at the end of class, I do a Q&A just for a bit to answer the unresolved questions. And I try to make it like I used to teach high school before I went back to school and became a professor. So I try to wander around the room when they're doing their activities and actually interact with them. But my goal is to never read PowerPoint slides to a class ever again.
That sounds like a lot of fun. What is your actual lecture entitled? I mean, what do they sign up for?
I primarily teach three courses. One is just called Learning. It's just about learning and the brain and how people learn. One is Fundamentals of Cognitive Neuroscience, which is basically what we call a survey course. So we talk about like attention, memory, perception, sort of all the basic things you need for cognition, but from a neuroscience perspective. The other one's a little less exciting. It's biomedical statistics. So it's basically how you do research statistics. So you can, you know, when scientists say something is true, it's all about how they get to that point statistically.
That is so brilliant. So how did you get interested in learning as the big topic?
So I was a high school teacher. When I graduated from my undergrad degree in 1997, my goal in life was to be a basketball coach. So one of my teaching areas was physical education, because that made a lot of sense. And then just by sheer luck, I went to see one of the university counselors and sort of said, well, what's my other teaching area be? Like, I really like history. And she looked at my transcript and said, looks like you got A's in physics in high school and in university. And that's a good thing. And she said, the other issue is that there's going to be 300 people graduating with history as a teaching area. And if you take physics, there'll be like two. So you're going to get a job. And I kind of like physics. I was lucky. I had this amazing high school physics teacher, Mr. McCauley, and he just made physics fun and interesting. So I said, physics and physical education. It's a strange combo, but I'll do it. So in 1997, you know, when I walked out of UVic with my degree and went off to teach high school, if you had told me I'd have a PhD in neuroscience, I would have been the first person to fall over laughing. Like, it was not on the horizon at all. So I taught 2 years here in Victoria, and I taught 2 years in England. And I was just wondering what to do next with life. And I thought, a professor of mine had always said, you should go to grad school. So I actually went to grad school to become a basketball coach. I went to Indiana in the United States, and I was going to be a basketball coach. I just wanted to have a master's degree.
Wow.
And we had an elective slot first semester, and you could fill it with any course you wanted. And I looked through the courses, and there was this course called Intro to Neuroscience. And there was a blurb about learning in the brain. And I thought, well, you know, I'm a teacher already. You know, I'm a coach. Like, I teach people. This is what I do. You know, this might be useful. And from the very first lecture, I was fascinated. I was just completely hooked. Oh. By the end of the semester, I'd given up coaching as a dream. I realized I was going to do a PhD. And it just became my passion. And then, you know, over the years, it's transitioned a bit. We also do decision making now. So our two fundamental research areas in my lab are learning and decision making. That was mostly because the whole purpose to learn is to help you make better decisions, right? So after doing a lot of learning, we figured we kind of had to look at the other end of the equation. And yeah, that's it. So there's been this theme of teaching and learning throughout my life, right? So it just sort of changed what I thought I'd be doing. My best friend from university teaches a local high school, and I could have had that life. Like, that could have been me, right? You know, I just a couple doors opened up and then here I am.
That's amazing. But the best of it is you've got to be curious about what you do. I mean, if you're not curious, there's no point, right?
I love my job. my mother, God bless her, worked a series of jobs that she didn't really like because she needed to for income. And one of the lessons she imparted to me was, you know, find a career that you really wanted to. And I love my job. I wake up every day and I'm like, what are we going to do today?
Yeah.
You know, and it makes it fun.
Well, that's a blessing. Not everybody can do that. Where did you actually grow up? Where were you born?
I was born in Vancouver, but we moved around a lot. My dad was a maritime engineer. So by the time I got to grade 8, I'd lived in Panama, Indonesia, Turkey. Yeah, we did a lot of traveling, New Zealand. So we moved around a lot. And then when I got to grade 8, my mother put her foot down and said, look, he's going to the same high school for 5 years. And my dad had always wanted to retire to someplace in the countryside and live off the land, you know, get a farm, this kind of thing. So they picked Salmon Arm, BC. I don't know the basis of that decision to this day, but I went to junior high and senior high. So I was born in Vancouver. I grew up in Salmon Arm, which is roughly true, but I live in Victoria because I came here to join the military out of high school.
Oh.
I didn't start at university right away. I did 3 years in the armed forces before I went to the University of Victoria.
Which service?
Combat arms, infantry, armored, artillery. Yeah, the army, basically.
Wow, cool.
And then I left that to go to the University of Victoria. And actually, I left to play basketball. I was playing a lot of basketball, and I played for the armed forces national team.
Nice.
Then my coach basically said, you're wasting your time here. You should go to UVic. So I did.
Wow, you have done a lot, that's for sure.
I you know what they say, when you die, your life flashes in front of your eyes. I want it to be like the most amazing movie ever. That's my goal.
Well, you're not far off already.
Well, hopefully I'm not dying soon.
No. But you played basketball for England and New Zealand, didn't you?
Yeah, so yeah. Basically, Ted, they said professional. Semi-professional is a better word because we got paid, but we weren't paid a lot. So basically, I went down and played a season in New Zealand after I played in college for 4 years. And then I went down and played a season in New Zealand. And I actually retired after that. I thought, you know, it wasn't a lot of money. And I thought, I'm just going to go back and teach high school. Which I did. Mm-hmm. And then I said, I taught 2 years in England. And when I was over there, just by random luck, I bumped into a friend from Canada who was playing in a semi-pro league there. And he's like, Olav, you should be playing here. So I played 2 seasons in England. And again, the money wasn't fantastic, but at least, you know, it was fun and I got to play again. So I extended my playing career by a couple of years after college.
Something you enjoyed again.
Yep.
Now, see, my brain, this is the problem with me. It's gone off in all sorts of different directions. So what's next?
Being a dad, my son's kind of the major focus of my life. I single parent half the time, and when Owen's with me, he's sort of the reason for most things. Professionally, we're waiting for COVID to end. Yeah. We had an opportunity to go to Nepal and collect some data, and that's on hold. We wanted to go up high. I've already gone there once, but we wanted to go back. We have a follow-up project with NASA that's on hold. We spent a week in the Mars habitat back in 2019, and we're supposed to do a 3-week mission. And that was the proof of concept before the tech was approved to possibly go to space. Right. And that's on hold.
The technology that you've been working on, is that something that would be really useful for people going to Mars?
Yeah, basically the idea is that on a Mars mission, the astronauts are going to experience changes in brain function. My talk was primarily focused on cognitive fatigue, but we also look at depression, anxiety, stress. And currently the gold standard to measure those things is to ask an astronaut, how are you doing today, right? And NASA, you know, the Mars mission is 3 years in duration, a year to get there, a year on the surface, a year to come home. And they want to be able to monitor the astronaut's brain function. They can monitor blood sugar. They can monitor heart rate. They can monitor breathing, but they can't monitor the brain. Mm-hmm. So the whole point of the mobile tech is to try to develop a way that they can monitor the brains. You can imagine if an astronaut, say, starts getting really depressed, they're probably not going to tell anybody, but the crew needs to know because there's a potential problem there. Mm-hmm. Same with cognitive fatigue. You could imagine that astronaut Sue Hall is going to be assigned to go outside on a mission. Well, if you're cognitively fatigued, we should probably switch it to, you know, another astronaut.
Yeah.
So the idea is to develop a quick and mobile assessment of brain function so that they know which astronauts are in what brain states.
That's fascinating. There's really no end to where you could go with that, right?
Oh, we have a range of projects on the go. Currently, we've got a project here with Island Health where we're seeing if we can diagnose mild cognitive impairment and dementia. And the idea is right now, most people that get dementia have had it for 4 to 5 years. It's just taken that long for the symptoms to be that noticeable and for a medical diagnosis. So you could imagine that if you could diagnose that in year one, you can't cure it. But mm-hmm. intervention is everything, right? Like the mm-hmm. earlier you can intervene and start doing things to strengthen mm-hmm. the brain. So that project, we're collecting that data right now, even during COVID, we've got people mm-hmm. coming in and we're testing them. Mm-hmm. And we've done a whole range of other things. We've looked at concussion assessment on the sports field, performance prediction also on the sports field, a whole lot of cognitive fatigue. I'm fatigued of cognitive fatigue. We've done so much of it.
But these days in my world with the kids, I mean, so many of them come up and say, I've got anxiety. And to be honest, that really annoys me because I always think of anxious as being an adjective, like you're a person who feels anxious. And now anxiety is a sort of whole entity of its own and people have it. You know what I mean? I'm not sure how I feel about it.
You should have my PhD student, Tom, on here. That his big shtick is anxiety and stress. He would tell you that anxiety is a thing because we definitely have people that have anxiety. I don't know enough clinically to speak to it, but from a neuroscience perspective, we definitely have people who you can detect that there's a different pattern of brain activity. And if you do the other tests for anxiety, they're clearly anxious.
Right.
Their brain is definitely in a different state than if they're not anxious.
That makes sense. Totally. So when you find this out, do you hand it over to the clinical people? It's wonderful to diagnose it, but obviously you have to do something about it.
Yeah, well, with the dementia project, we're working directly with a medical doctor, Dr. Alex Henry Vargava. He's the head of the Cognitive Health Initiative here. With the stress and anxiety stuff, that would be the idea, which is we mm-hmm. publish the findings and then the medical people sort of say, well, what can you do with mm-hmm. this? You know, that's why I really love the mobile technologies is because, if it took you 3 hours to do an anxiety assessment, that might be useful, it might not be, but if you can do it in 3 minutes, anywhere at any time, that sort of changes things.
And a lot of people can't actually express themselves very well when they are feeling depressed or anxious. They can't always find the words to complete the 3-hour examination.
Well, exactly. Yeah, that's actually the tricky part in a lot of these studies. It's hard to get people that are depressed or anxious to come into the lab because they're depressed or they're anxious, right?
So, totally. It's more stress than it means getting out of bed and that's amazing. This is really very interesting. Olaf, is there anything that you would like to tell the listeners about your work, about where you'd like it to go, about any help that you need, any volunteers? Is there anything that we can help publicize for you?
That's a great question. I guess what I'd say is that these kind of technologies are coming. It's not like some little niche thing that's going to stay in a lab. You know, the example I use is most people have some form of heart rate monitor on their wrists, you know, at any given time now. You know, if you have a mobile phone, you've got a GPS device that's tracking how many steps you take every day and can assess your fitness.
Yeah.
The mobile technology in the glasses shows that you could actually track people's brains very unobtrusively. That is a technology that's coming. In terms of what people could do to help us, just support science. In Canada, people, when they hear about a lab like mine, think we're funded by millions of dollars. And the reality is we operate off of a budget that's less than $100,000 a year. And so it's a shoestring budget because over the last 20 years, there's been a de-emphasis on basic science. And there has to be basic science if we're going to solve these problems. Everything can't be an application. And I forget what I was reading the other day, but I read a really interesting piece where they were talking about how technology is improving, but it's not advancing, which is we've had computers for a while now and they're getting faster and they look a little bit nicer. But what's the next thing? Like, what's the next big advancement, right? Mm-hmm. And that they thought the rate of advancement was slowing down. Because if you think back to the 1900, there were no planes, then there's planes, then there's cars, and there's all these new technologies appeared. So there was concern that the rate of technology was changing. And to me, if that's a true statement, and I'm not sure that it is, that might be tied to this idea that we're not doing the basic science that allows these new ideas to form. So I would tell all of your listeners to have an interest in science and wherever they can support it, whatever form it is, whether it's supporting like what I do or what other scientists do.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of brings us full circle in a way, because sadly you'll hear that I couldn't handle physics or chemistry or biology at school because I couldn't handle the way it was taught. it was read a textbook and, you know, put a piece of litmus into this solution, but never telling me why. Being a big picture thinker, I needed to know why I was doing this to be able to enjoy the steps. Maybe the advancements are going to help the teaching process too.
Definitely. The most important place to start with this stuff is at the beginning, right? Like, you know, science curriculum, the most important area is the elementary school. Because, you know, we have this world where people are saying, well, I can't do math or I'm not a mathematician. Well, I don't buy that. I think it's being taught poorly. And in the same with science, obviously, because we teach some things so very well and other things we don't teach as well. And as a scientist, I have a bit of a bias, obviously, but anyone can do what I do. It's just a matter of having it explained properly so that you can learn how to do it.
Exactly. And I hated math too. And now because of the work that I do and we have a math program, I think it's great. I get it. I understand why people could be excited by it, but they never tell you the good stuff. Like, yeah. For example, I believe when math first started, it was the ancient Greeks who wanted to discover things about stars and the distances and all the rest of it. And it was seen to be heresy. So apparently they did all their workings out in the wet sand so that the tide would come in and wash away their workings out and they'd never be arrested as heretics.
Oh.
I mean, I don't know how true that is either, but
if it's true, that's a great story. I'd love to find out about the origins of that.
But the thing is, if they told me that, true or not, I'd have been a little bit more interested from the word go.
As someone that teaches statistics for a living, all I can say is that sometimes it's a lot of work to make those topics interesting, but it can be done. You just got to really push, really think outside the box.
Absolutely. If you love the subject, I mean, that makes it a lot easier.
Well, that's the other thing too, because you got to put passionate people in the classroom that love to teach these subjects. And there's times where, you know, I've met some of my son's teachers and I kind of went, you don't like this subject. Like, why are you teaching it? Like, it doesn't. And I, having been a high school teacher, sometimes it's because the principal says, like, one year they made me teach chemistry and it was a disaster because I didn't like chemistry and I didn't know what I was doing. But I had to teach it. It was part of my job, right?
But going back to my audience, I know dyslexia is not your specialty or anything like that. But somewhere in that conversation, I thought to myself, I wonder if one day the kids would be able to put a band on their head and literally within 3 minutes, somebody would say, well, you have this way of thinking and you have that way of thinking. Because the reason I say that, at the moment, there is no definitive test for dyslexia. Even the educational psychologists will agree with that. They collect a bunch of symptoms and they say this is most likely, but there is no definitive test. The work that I do, we ask people if they can alter their perceptions, but obviously that's not fully accepted yet. So that would be amazing from our point of view.
It would be a really cool study to run, and it wouldn't be a hard one. You would just need to measure the brainwaves of a bunch of kids without dyslexia, and you'd have to measure the brainwaves of a bunch of kids with dyslexia.
Yeah.
And the way we work, and I don't want to get too technical, but the math that we use, basically, we call them classifiers. And the math, if it has enough training data, and what I mean by that is you have enough data from kids or brain measurements from kids without dyslexia, and you have enough brain measurements from kids with dyslexia, these classifiers learn to separate it. It's kind of like the way that a lot of people now have a phone that will unlock if they look at it. Well, your phone's learning what your face looks like. It doesn't know what your face looks like. Mm-hmm. It's not taking a picture and matching it. It's actually learning, and it's building what we call a classifier. So we can do that with that brainwave data. We just need it. It sounds like a cool project.
Sounds like we've got an idea there.
We do have an idea there.
Money and time. That's all we need.
That's what slows down research the most, is just that at the end of the day, I have to find money so the grad students can go out and do the actual work. Luckily, the university pays the power bills, but, you know, I have to find the grant money to buy the headsets and the computers and the rest of it.
Olaf, I'm pretty sure we could go on a bit longer. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you really wanted to go in that direction?
No, I thank you for having me so much, and enjoy science, everyone. It's amazing.
Now we have to look for you.
Yeah, so my podcast is That Neuroscience Guy. It's on Apple, Google. And what the podcast is about is basically they're just short clips, 12 to 13 minutes. And they're about day-to-day life. Episode one is about why we impulse shop. You know, we just did an episode on depression, so the neural basis of depression. We have one about grabbing an apple, and people think that sounds kind of boring, but the actual stuff that goes on your head for something as simple as that. So we're trying to pick just everyday things that people can relate to and give you a quick little insight into how it works in 12 minutes or so.
I truly believe there's no one more fascinating to me than me, and no one more fascinating to you than you. Yes. And when you figure out why you do these things, it's cool. Very, very cool.
And that's what I try to do. I try to explain the neuroscience behind it without all the shop talk. So just put it in words that everyone will get.
I think that's amazing. Thank you so much. Maybe your podcast should be in school science lessons.
I could only hope.
That would be awesome. That would be very cool. We'd have to start a trend. So thank you, Olaf, very, very much indeed. And if you would like to get hold of Olaf, please go to
www.olavkrigolson.com. OlavKrigolson.com.
Brilliant. And we'll put it in the text of the podcast as well. So thank you to everyone who's listening. Please subscribe, follow, share. And if you'd like to see what the whole Dyslexic Society is up to, please go to www.thewds.org. And we'd love to hear from you at info@thewds.org. I hope you'll join us to hear some of the speakers and more of the TEDx Bear Creek Park organizing and coaching team. So until next time, take care, stay well, and bye for now.